Howdy, everybody. We had a bit of an editing crisis with the video that was supposed to go out today, so you're actually going to get an extra video this month. Since we didn't want to deviate from our upload schedule, we've decided to release the first episode of our Means TV exclusive series, The New F-Word, completely free here on YouTube. This is a project from a few years back where we partnered with one of the leading academics in comparative fascist studies and tried to put together a sort of crash course on historical and modern fascism. If you'd like to check out the rest of the series, you can watch the whole thing and support the channel by signing up for Means TV using my link in the description. If you're not familiar with Means, it's a worker-owned cooperative and explicitly anti-capitalist streaming service. You can find everything from my videos to original series like Means Morning News to feature-length documentaries like Abby Martin's Gaza Fights for Freedom, with more amazing content being added every day. I've been working behind the scenes to help turn Means TV into a place that's worthwhile for viewers, as well as offering financial security for socialist creators in an increasingly reactionary political landscape. Every creator on the platform has a unique link, and when anyone signs up using that link, that creator directly benefits from the subscription. I have mine listed below, but if you really appreciate another creator's work, make sure to use their link instead. All of us at Means are trying really hard to build an alternative media ecosystem that is ideologically dedicated to sharing left-wing perspectives. With Means TV, we're able to say things the way they are. No pulling punches, no beating around the bush to trick the all-seeing eye of the algorithm. Means gives us the freedom to make the content we really want to make and say the things we really want to say. There's even a community forum where creators can engage with each other and fans right on the platform. As a little thank you for watching our channel, if you sign up with our link, or another creator's if you prefer, you can get your first month 20% off. Or for an even better deal, you can opt for the annual plan and get 20% off the whole year. A full year of Means TV will run you less than $90, which is like the cost of a single DoorDash meal these days. Every person who signs up using a creator's link is directly contributing to the financial stability of that channel and the entire cooperative media project. None of this would be possible without the generosity of viewers like you. Means TV is entirely grassroots funded, and it always will be. So if you'd like to help support our work, consider signing up for Means TV using the link below. It really does help the team here at Second Thought, and dozens of other principled creators across the platform. So, without further ado, please enjoy the first episode of my exclusive series, The New F-Word. Have you ever been bullied by some sort of hostile in-group? Or been put down by a person in authority, like a teacher or sports coach? Or had a run-in with a particularly obnoxious bureaucrat or traffic cop? Or been humiliated by a club bouncer taking perverse pleasure in preventing you from having fun? Or have you had to deal with some pathetic individual who seemed to enjoy the temporary power over you their position gave them? Was there ever a flare-up with your parents when they seemed, well, just far too parental? Or have you ever felt outraged at seeing footage of riot police using water cannons or worse to attack citizens peacefully protesting against some outrageous form of discrimination? Or ruthlessly assaulting or shooting at ordinary people just because they were pushing back against the state abuse of power? Or has it been you out there in the street being physically assaulted by the forces of law and order? In such moments, you may have felt a rush as adrenaline and cortisol pump through your veins and your blood boils. This is a defensive, biochemical reaction hardwired over millions of years of evolution. But ever since humans developed language, it also seems to trigger a barely resistible impulse to yell out a whole string of choice phrases to warn off the aggressor. But in many Western cultures, there's another type of word available in brief encounters with oppressors and aggressors. It's another short F-word, not vulgar or obscene in itself, a little word, but used with an artistic sense of timing, it can have a big, self-assertive, inflammatory impact. The word, of course, is fascist. This series will probably not suppress the Pavlovian reflex to accuse aggressors or authoritarians of being fascist, but it should at least help you understand what a slippery, contested word it has become. An informed use of the word, as opposed to a cathartic or expletive one, is particularly valuable in context when it matters to use the term more technically, precisely, and meaningfully. Examples would be in political journalism, social media, a research essay, an academic debate about different types of oppression, or the analysis of the enemies of democracy or humanity. At the very least, these 12 episodes should empower you to spot its vagueness when it's tossed around with irritating imprecision and frequency, like when people complain about climate fascism, health fascism, or body fascism. Of course, you may be watching this because you already have a clear idea of what fascism is and are already engaged in fighting it, perhaps as part of an organization combating discrimination. Or you may have joined a protest movement led by concerned citizens determined not to let their democracy be taken over by extremism. You may already be an anti-fascist activist. In all such cases, you probably have a pretty good idea of the threat to society you want to counter. Whatever your starting point or premises, you are welcome. Or perhaps you're working for a U.S. state agency monitoring social media and certain YouTube channels for extremism. In which case, you too are welcome. You may learn something. If you just get a little more frustrated every time you come across the word fascist, if you're annoyed by its exasperatingly vague, ill-defined use by so many of its critics, this series is for you. Even if you already hold passionate beliefs about what fascism is, beliefs that differ from the opinions expressed here, it's also for you. While you may continue to disagree with the approach recommended in these episodes, they should encourage you to refine your own concept of what you're fighting and become more aware of the different forms fascism's attack on existing society can assume today, often very different from the way it expressed itself between the two world wars. Some of them are brilliantly camouflaged or entirely decentralized, and practically invisible without expert knowledge of where to look. If you're still not sure you might benefit from this series, try this simple experiment. It should let you experience firsthand the problem this first episode addresses, the problem of definition. Find a friend or a small group willing to discuss the meaning of fascism for 10 minutes or so, preferably people you consider generally knowledgeable about politics or the state of the world. Each of you is given up to 5 minutes to sketch out the defining characteristics of fascism alone, without discussion or access to Wikipedia. Then you compare notes. It is almost guaranteed there will be significant differences, in which case, talk them through to identify them, clarify them, and hopefully resolve them, in order to come up with a better consensus. This experiment will probably illustrate how some of the most commonly used words defy simple definition. Fascist is one of those words. Because it's identified with major events in modern history involving millions of lives and scores of nations, it has attracted enormous attention over the years. The more people have gotten involved trying to define it, the more opinions and approaches have tended to proliferate. In academia, a general consensus normally emerges about the most functional definition when applied to different case studies and research projects so that, though not fixed in stone, it serves as a kind of industry standard. In the case of fascist studies, we'll see that not one, but two major competing definitions of fascism have established themselves in this way, only one of which will form the basis of this series. The next episode will establish the definition of fascism we're going to use for the series. But for the moment, and for the sake of completeness, it's important to outline the approach we're not going to use, especially since it has a lot to be said for it. It is a valuable source of insight into aspects of fascist practice, its intimate relationship to several conservative interests in maintaining the status quo, its war on the left, and its persecution of entire categories of humanity. For convenience, we'll call it the Marxist theory of fascism. Though in reality, it's a tradition or school of theory made up of many nuanced and original applications of the same basic interpretation. The core Marxist theory of fascism was born of the dramatic situation that arose within months of a carefully staged event in Milan in March 1919. It was here that Benito Mussolini formally founded the first of the Fasci di Combattimento, from which the generic term fascism is derived. The title translates literally as fighting leagues. But it is significant for understanding the ethos and purpose of the group that the name also evokes war veterans. For example, the organization set up in 1917 to help demobilized Italian soldiers was called Opera Nazionale Combattenti, or National Veterans Association. The First World War, which had only ended 5 months earlier, had released back into civilian life hundreds of thousands of Italian soldiers who had been through a horrific war with precious little for Italy to show for it. Mussolini looked to them as the new patriotic, heroic elite that would spearhead a national revolution. The symbol of Mussolini's new movement was a sort of pun. The word fascio could refer to the Roman fasces, or lictor's rod. This was a curious ceremonial object that looked a bit like the Gatling gun used in the American Civil War. In ancient Rome, it was carried by a state official called a lictor, and consisted of a bundle of rods for flogging the condemned tied around the handle of an axe for executing them. It was thus a symbol of the state's total power of life and death over its citizens, or rather its subjects. But fascio could also mean a bundle, and an association or league of political activists trying to get something done. It was this double significance that Mussolini exploited when he chose the Roman fasci symbol for the campaign group, which he set up in 1915 to pressure the government into giving up Italy's neutrality and enter the First World War. It was called the Fascio of Revolutionary Action, the direct forerunner of the Fasci di Combattimento. As the manifesto of the movement made clear at its launch, fascisti claimed to be revolutionary nationalists, bent on replacing liberal democracy with a new Italy which would benefit the whole population. But were they really? From the outset, Marxists saw this new group very differently. The Russian Revolution had happened in 1917, and revolutionary Marxists throughout Europe started to believe their time had come and that world history was about to turn in their favor. From the summer of 1919 till early 1921, a period known as the Biennio Rosso, or Red 2 Years, Italy was swept by mass strikes, sit-ins, lockouts, marches, rallies, and both social and industrial unrest spearheaded by Marxist activists. Class war had at last broken out. But it was not the government that fought back against the coming Bolshevik Revolution. It was local squads of paramilitary fascisti, known as squadristi, that sprang up in the center and north of Italy to fight. They were organized by the commander of the local fascio, the RAS, often a former officer of the Arditi, the specialized troops who served in the Italian equivalent of the modern Marines or SAS. The conclusion to be drawn from a socialist perspective was obvious. The new political movement of fascism was the violent face of capitalism. Under threat from the left, the pseudo-liberal Italian state had dropped its democratic mask. Rather than using the army or police, it was now resorting to proxy paramilitary violence to defend the economic interests of landowners, businessmen, and international finance capital against the people, those trapped in rural poverty and wage slavery. One epic Italian film with great American actors, Bertolucci's 1900, is based on this interpretation of the squadristi war with the left and against the people. Its message is that fascism was, in its origins and by its nature, an extreme, viciously aggressive form of anti-communist politics. Deeply reactionary, counter-revolutionary, anti-progressive, anti-modern, as well as being unspeakably violent, inhuman, and sadistic. In the film, a fascist, played by Donald Sutherland, headbutts a cat to death to illustrate how to treat communists. It's on YouTube if you're interested. For Marxists, all forms of fascism are characterized by a vision of future nationalist or racist glory, by appeals to patriotism, by promises to the people of the rise of the nation like a phoenix in a powerful new order, announcing a new era of civilization. But this is all empty rhetoric and propaganda. The fascist state is a facade, a film set. Behind the scenes, it is organizing its war on society, on the very people it is glorifying. Interwar fascism had no ideology, policies, or vision beyond those of smash socialism, defend the status quo at any cost, and keep the ruling elites in power. Since the war, it has been forced by the defeat of the Axis to oppose the emancipation of ordinary people in new ways and in new disguises. Once the fog of its rhetoric was blown away by Marxist analysis, the real political program of Mussolini's original fascism could be seen for what it was. A policy of systematic repression, driven by the simple imperative to keep subjugating and exploiting the working masses, destroy any trade unions, movements, and parties that tried to emancipate them, and nip in the bud any socialist initiatives for liberation and genuine solidarity. This meant using violence and state power to crush the first sign of socialist militancy or violence. It also meant silencing those elements of the intelligentsia who, inspired by Marx and Lenin, attempted to raise proletarian consciousness and disseminate revolutionary ideas to break the chains of the proletariat and remove their capitalist shackles. Thanks to their scientific analysis of the evils of capitalism, radical socialists, whether revolutionary, communist, or gradualist, social democrat, and labor party, knew instinctively that everything Mussolini's fascists, or their later emulators in other countries, said in speeches and manifestos or claimed in their calls for a national rebirth and renewal was a fake ideology and promised a fake revolution. Its visions of restoring a heroic nationalism would inevitably lead in practice only to more capitalist profit, by increasing the misery and poverty of the laboring masses and imprisoning them even more in suffering and lies. Moreover, fascism's ultra-nationalist rhetoric of violence, imperialism, and national greatness would lead necessarily to a new round of wars which pitted the urban and rural workers against their comrades in other countries, as had already happened in the First World War, and to new episodes of mass suffering and death which would line the pockets of investors in key economic sectors. Within months of the first fascio being formed, Marxists could predict that, as a child of capitalism's pathological fear of socialism, fascism would be imitated by other capitalist nations in crisis. Fascism was thus not just a uniquely Italian affair. It was a generic phenomenon of counter-revolution. It was old wine in new bottles. Its rise had to be monitored and militantly opposed wherever it appeared. The brilliance of Marxist interpretations of the first fascism is in their flexibility. They adapted effortlessly to world events as they unfolded after the First World War, and their worst fears seemed to be realized. In the course of the 1920s and 1930s, ever more Western, Latin American, and Asian nations, whether democratic or authoritarian, hosted racist or nationalist movements, often with programs for territorial or imperial expansion. They were based not just on hatred and violence directed against outgroups, especially black people in the US and Jews in Europe, but on the demonization of socialists and communists. Marxists knew they were witnessing an international tsunami of reaction to prolong the death throes of capitalism and crush the global socialist revolution, which communists believed had been triggered by the Russian Revolution. Thus, when leaders such as Horthy, Salazar, Pilsudski, King Alexander, Dollfuss, Franco, Metaxas, and Vargas took over state power in Hungary, Portugal, Poland, Austria, Yugoslavia, Spain, Greece, and Brazil, when new paramilitary or political right-wing movements arose, such as the Legions of Archangel Michael in Romania, the Rex Party in Belgium, the National Socialist Movement in the Netherlands, the British Union of Fascists, the National Rally in Norway, the Integralist Brazilian Action, the Chilean National Socialist, the South African Asebrandvag, when Chiang Kai-shek took the Chinese Nationalist Party, Kuomintang, in an increasingly militaristic direction after 1925, for Marxists, nothing mysterious was happening. It was all too predictable. On the pretext of saving the nation and civilization itself from destruction at the hands of inner enemies, socialism, Bolshevism, and liberalism, a pandemic of reactionary violence was spreading through the world to postpone the ultimate victory of socialism. Its name was fascism. The empirical realities of the Third Reich and its many millions of individual crimes against humanity amply confirmed what Marxists had identified as the fundamentally counter-revolutionary and destructive core of fascism's permutation of capitalism. This was also evident in the regime's systematic destruction of left-wing organizations and persecution of socialists and communists, and the extensive collusion between German industry, big business, technology, and science with the Third Reich. Emblematic of this collusion was how IG Farben set up a vast factory within Auschwitz to take advantage of its slaves to manufacture artificial rubber, how Daimler-Benz forced the women of Ravensbrück concentration camp to produce bomber engines, and how the original system for keeping track of prisoners in the camps was supplied by IBM's German subsidiary using the latest punch card technology, thanks to investment by the parent company in the States. Marxist analysis was also borne out by the proliferation of extreme right-wing, ultranationalist, authoritarian, militaristic, and racist movements and regimes that have arisen throughout the modern world both before and since the Second World War. In their various ways, all have been dedicated to crushing communist and social democratic organizations and neutralizing any attempts to achieve progress towards global economic and racial social justice. Marxist theory is not monolithic. There are different schools of theorizing in Marxist fascist studies, distinguished by such terms as agent, Bonapartist, Freudian, Soviet, Trotskyist, Frankfurt School, Euro-Marxist, structuralist, and post-structuralist. Nor is there any shortage of original, highly intelligent, and well-researched contributions by individual Marxist intellectuals, such as Zetkin, Reich, Bauer, Thalmann, Thalhammer, Gramsci, Adorno, Newman, Polanski, Foucault, Laclau, and Renton. Yet the shared bedrock on which all their distinctive theoretical edifices are constructed is that fascism in all its forms, including right-wing and populist democratic politics which oppose the revolutionary transformation of society in a socialist direction, is shaped by the telltale DNA of capitalism. It is this which determines the perpetuation of its characteristic social evils: insurmountable class barriers, structural poverty, the exploitation and alienation of the masses, the repression of emancipatory movements, the propagation of nationalistic, ethnic, imperialist, and cultural hatreds, the violence and terror deployed against alleged enemies when the democratic gloves are off. At its heart, fascism is capitalism in jackboots, capitalism on steroids, capitalism at its most psychotic and anti-human. One interpretation most memorably articulated in the declaration of the Bulgarian communist Dimitrov at the Seventh World Congress of the Communist Third International in 1935 is that fascism, quote, is the open, terrorist dictatorship of the most reactionary, most chauvinistic, and most imperialist elements of finance capital. He went on to say, fascism is the source of finance capital itself. It is the organization of terrorist vengeance against the working class and the revolutionary section of the peasantry and intelligentsia. In foreign policy, fascism is jingoism in its most brutal form, fomenting bestial hatred of other nations. He added that the development of fascism and the fascist dictatorship itself assume different forms in different countries, according to historical, social, and economic conditions, and to the national peculiarities and the international position of the given country. Armed with such a core definition, or a closely related set of assumptions, Marxists see the defeat of the Axis in 1945 as far from marking the end of fascism. On the contrary, with the revival of capitalism in its liberal democratic and pseudo-democratic forms, fascism has simply adopted new tactics and guises, new ways to foment those bestial hatreds based on class, ethnicity, or imperialist interests, often teaming up with ultra-conservative forms of religion. They have thus had no problem seeing potent variants of the fascist virus in the brutal war on socialism in Pinochet's Chile and Argentina's military dictatorship, or in the horrors of apartheid South Africa. They also find it easy to decode the fascist subtext in Erdogan's Turkey, Putin's Russia, or Modi's India, while identifying telltale signs of it lurking in Thatcher's Britain, the US of Nixon and George W. Bush, de Gaulle's France, and even the European Union. From this standpoint, fascism also lay behind the hypercapitalism of the masters of the universe, which led to the 2008 financial meltdown and years of austerity for the people. The Marxist theory of fascism is a powerful diagnostic tool for unmasking fascism and peering beneath the deceptive surface of its treacherous rhetoric of national renewal, greatness, and sacrifice in any historical context. Once it is applied uncritically to Trump's presidency, his key Republican supporters, and many of his more radical followers committed to destroying the entire Washington swamp, it's tempting to categorize his entire movement as fascist. After all, he can be held to represent the worst excesses of parasitic finance capitalism and conspicuous consumption, combined with a full portfolio of the character traits of someone with a fascist disposition. An ultra-nationalist and racist conception of the state, moral corruption and abuse of privilege, unaccountable power, megalomania, nepotism, dynastic pretensions, the abuse of organized religion, ingrained chauvinism, and narcissism. No less revealing are his pathological hatreds of Mexicans, Muslims, women, people of color, poor people, those with special needs and disabilities, social justice, universal rights, democracy, and reason itself, whether intellectual or scientific. For tactical reasons, he parades his readiness to be a friend of the Israeli hard right. But that has not prevented him from making anti-Semitic remarks. It's no wonder the left-wing intelligentsia, socialist writers and social media users, and many liberal academics have converged on the same verdict, that both Trump and the marginalized forces he has legitimized are modern American fascists. But even in this seemingly open and shut case, a proper Marxist analysis can yield some doubts. Did the assorted right-wing forces Trump mobilized really possess the human intelligence, the coherent vision, and the capacity for long-term political planning to further fascist agendas in office? Wasn't he just little more than a grifter, trying to use the presidency to satisfy his narcissistic greed for popularity, money, and power? Not a fascist, but a parasite on an already essentially parasitic body politics erected by bourgeois and oligarchical capitalism to perpetuate the servitude of the masses at home and abroad. I'll leave this question open for other Marxists to resolve, especially because this series will not actually be using the Marxist approach. Instead, it uses a working definition increasingly used by non-Marxist researchers in international comparative fascist studies. It is based on a humanism which condemns practically everything Trump has ever stood for, but comes at him from a different angle to reach a different conclusion about what political box to put him in and how to label his mainstream support. With this conceptual cliffhanger, I hope we can lure you back to watch episode 2, where a completely different story of fascism and analysis of its role in the contemporary world emerges.